Hello, welcome to Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center Defense and Intelligence Podcast. I'm Project Director Kevin Ryan. This is Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, and our guest is Dr. Diane Funstein, whose research is on compelling military threats in U.S. foreign policy. Diane earned her Ph.D. in political science from Columbia University in 2012 and is currently on leave from her position as an assistant professor at UMass Amherst to be a postdoctoral research fellow here in the International Security Program at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center. Welcome, Diane.
Thanks, Kevin.
Now, when I typed this into my piece of paper here to read from, the word compellent did not come up on the dictionary in the word processor. So tell me, what is or are compellent military threats?
Well, thank you. Yes, you're right that that word is one that I'm constantly seeing underlined in red in my own research. But a compellent military threat is a threat in which the United States or another actor demands some change in behavior from a target state and backs that with a promise or a threat of military action in the event of noncompliance. And I wanted to use the word compellent threats to distinguish them from deterrent threats, which are threats that are intended to stop an adversary from taking some future action. If you think about sort of Cold War era deterrence with nuclear weapons, those are not the kinds of threats I'm talking about. I'm interested in a threat where, for example, the United States demands another state give up its WMDs or relinquish a piece of territory it's recently occupied and then promises to attack if they don't. So that's sort of the phenomenon of cases that I'm looking at.
All right. Well, so I understand the words. I'm not sure I understand completely the idea, though. Do you have a case study or two that you're actually looking at that you could use to better clarify for me?
Sure. So during 2011, with the crisis that was unfolding in Libya, the UN passed a resolution authorizing the use of force to stop attacks on civilians. But the key part of the threat component that I'm interested in looking at is that the United States, specifically President Obama, made a very public speech in which he demanded that Gaddafi stop his attacks on civilians and rebel forces, specifically advancing on the city of Benghazi, and promised that the United States and its NATO allies would enforce a no-fly zone over Libya if Gaddafi did not comply. So that's a classic example of a compellent threat. And what I look at in my research is why states would choose to resist a threat like that, particularly a state like Libya, which is fairly weak compared to the United States and its NATO allies, which has this huge arsenal of military power at its disposal. So that's what I'm interested in, is why these weak states would resist threats coming from the world's most powerful state.
So when you mentioned deterrent threat, from my experience, I think back to the Cold War, and you referenced this, in the idea of mutual assured destruction. So
yes.
If Russia were to launch an attack against us, we would launch an overwhelming attack back against them. That's not a compellent military threat, or is that a deterrent military threat?
No, that would be a deterrent threat because you're trying to prevent the Soviet Union from taking some future action, which is launching an attack against you. Now, it's possible that a single threat can have can be intended both to compel and to deter, but I'm really looking at cases where you're actually asking the target to take some future action or change some action that they're undertaking. And the difference there is that it's much easier to observe compliance in the case of compellent threats because you're asking the target to take some action.
I see.
Yeah. With deterrence, compliance happens when there's no action. It's really difficult to measure, I think.
Well, last fall we had the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Was that an example of compellent or deterrent threat, or were they both existent in the same situation?
I would say they were both operating in the crisis, and I do classify the Cuban Missile Crisis as an example of a case in which the United States made a demand. In this case, it was for the removal of the missiles from Cuba, and had this sort of threatened invasion, these troops that were sort of massing in Florida preparing to invade in the event the Soviet Union chose not to comply. So.
All right. Well, what are the policy implications for this, for what you're researching and what you're trying to point out to us? Is there something we should be doing differently as a nation?
Sure. Well, I don't know if something will be done differently, because my basic argument and finding is that because the United States has adopted a lot of strategies to make the use of force relatively low cost, this means the threat of force is no longer a what we call a costly signal of U.S. motivation. That is, because it's relatively cheap now for us to use force against states like Libya and even a case like Iraq, it's not going to be that convincing when we say, hey, we're asking you to change your behavior, we're going to attack.
Wait a minute. If it's cheaper for us to attack them, why would they not be afraid that we would actually do it? Because it's almost like we could do it, you know, with leftover pocket money. Why is that not more compelling?
That's an excellent question. So I say that you're right, that they don't doubt, these targets don't doubt that we're going to actually launch some kind of limited attack. What they do doubt is that we actually have the motivation to stick around and keep applying more force if necessary after that initial attack fails.
Okay.
So air power is one of the ways that we've sort of shifted our focus to sort of standoff strike low-cost operations. And so I'm arguing that when we rely on instruments like this and things like drones, targets may not doubt that we're going to use the instrument and launch some kind of limited attack against them, but they doubt that we actually will sort of finish the job if they keep resisting after that threat fails.
So you mentioned drones.
Yes.
Do you see, I mean, I guess drones could be used in both a compellent, in response to a compellent military threat or as a deterrent military threat. But do you see them as being more of one than the other, or?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I've started doing some more work on drones very recently, and I hadn't really thought about using them for deterrence, but I think you're right that they could be used theoretically for both, but my research suggests that's not likely to be very effective. I think drones might be very good at targeting specific, you know, individuals or targets on the ground, but If my argument's correct, it also suggests that it's going to be really hard to coerce them without the use of force.
What would you term the current use of drones in Pakistan by the United States as a compelling military?
You know, I think that the way we're using drones now is not really coercion at all. If we think of compelling threats and deterrence, both fall under this broader umbrella of coercion, where you're trying to persuade actors to take some future action. I think actually the way we're using drones would qualify as what we call brute force, which is we're just destroying you. We're not trying to persuade you.
Just an extension of the battlefield.
Yeah, and I think it can have some coercive effects if you think that the drone strikes are also intended to influence the behavior and the sort of recruitment of potential new recruits or other people that are observing the strikes, and they might have some mild deterrent effect, but I think the main focus, from what I can tell, is just this brute force method. We're just going to take you out. So,
Diane, you remind me of a lot of other officers that I served with during my time in the Army, where we would sit around and talk about things like this. But you don't come from that background. Why are you studying compellent military threats? What interests you about this?
That's a good question. I think preparing for my comprehensive exams when I was working on my doctorate, this was sort of a phenomenon that I came across and sort of asking myself, why is it that these weak states would resist when they know the United States has the most powerful military in the world? And I think my interest in sort of military history probably came from my dad, who's a sort of amateur World War II history buff, but also being now a new member of the sort of the Army family, I guess, has also solidified my interest in this. So,
and if people wanted to know more about what you're researching and more about what you're writing about, is there some place they could go? Or have you published something already?
I'm actually in the process of negotiating with publishers for the manuscript on this project right now, but I have a page on the Belfer Center website. You can find me listed there, and a link to this, hopefully, and also to my new publications, forthcoming publications, I should say.
Okay. Well, thank you, Diane Funstein, very much for being with us today. This podcast has been brought to you by the Defense and Intelligence Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. I'm Kevin Ryan, And you can find this podcast and more by visiting our website at belfercenter.ksg.harvard.edu.